This is the Quality News Network. A report in the New York Times today says the Treasury Department has been obtaining information on international financial transactions since September 11th to track the flow of terrorist money. Today, the Treasury Secretary John Snow defended the program as an important source of information and added that it is consistent with our democratic values. In Miami, seven men have been indicted for homegrown terrorism, including a plot to blow up the Sears Tower in Chicago and other federal buildings to, quote, kill all the devils we can. The leader allegedly told the FBI informant who infiltrated the group that he was organizing an Islamic army in the U.S. to wage a jihad or holy war. The Iraqi government imposed a curfew today and declared a state of emergency following a firefight with insurgents outside of the heavily fortified Green Zone in Baghdad. Across Iraq, at least 17 people were killed in violent attacks that included an explosion outside of a Sunni mosque. Today, the U.S. military said that a senior member of al-Qaeda in Iraq was captured. In Washington, the top U.S. military leader in Iraq says Iran is helping Shiite groups conduct attacks in Iraq. He explained that Iran has increased its efforts in providing the violent groups with weapons and training so they can conduct terrorist operations against American troops. Also in Baghdad, the Iraqi government is expected to announce on a national reconciliation package to keep the country from falling into civil war. According to the UK Times Online, to win over the Sunnis, the proposal will offer amnesty to prisoners and include resistance groups in the political process. Many U.S. lawmakers are upset with the plan because of the amnesty offered to insurgents who killed U.S. troops. In the Pacific Ocean near Guam, the U.S. military has concluded the largest war games exercise in decades. In Tokyo, the United States and Japan have agreed to expand their joint ballistic missile defense shield. The agreement was worked out before the current threat from North Korea that it may launch a long-range missile. Former Democratic Vice President Walter Mondale says the U.S. should warn North Korea that if they don't dismantle their missile, quote, we are going to take it out. He says he supports a preemptive American military strike. And the mayor of San Jose, the nation's 10th largest city, has been arrested on bribery charges. You're listening to QNN.
In addition to producing and distributing the finest hourly newscasts in the country, the Quality News Network conducts interviews with 2006 candidates. We afford congressional and gubernatorial challengers of every political stripe the opportunity to illuminate their views and to demonstrate their character in a 20-minute network-quality interview. We perform this public service to enable voters to get a better listen to the people they might consider electing to high office. Because as Thomas Jefferson said, if a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. If you want to know more about who is running in the November elections, go to qualitynewsnetwork.com and click on 2006 candidates. If we are to get America back on track, we need to elect people who can lead us in the right direction. Now, back to the news.
In Washington, the White House spokesman announced that Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta will leave his post next month. He's the only Democrat in the president's cabinet. The first nuclear power plants to be built in the U.S. since 1973 will go up outside of Houston. Hitachi and General Electric have been chosen for the $5.2 billion project to build two nuclear reactors. The Commerce Department reports that durable goods orders fell 0.3% in May. It's the second straight month of declines in big-ticket factory orders, led by weak demand for commercial aircraft. The Securities and Exchange Commission is investigating one of the most widely known hedge funds in the country. The $7 billion PICO fund is under scrutiny for possible insider trading. The fund denies any wrongdoing. Verizon Airphone announced it will stop its commercial airline phone service by the end of the year. The familiar fixture has been on the back of airline seats for 20-plus years. Netflix, the online video rental company, is reportedly investing $5 to $10 million in digital download technology. The company that pioneered DVD rentals through the mail indicates that that method may soon be outdated. Light sweet crude settled at $68.94 a barrel today on the New York Mercantile Exchange and near the close of Wall Street this week. The Dow is down 29 points, the Nasdaq is down 1 point, and the S&P 500 is down 1 point. There's always more at our website, qualitynewsnetwork.com. I'm Allie Dramov.
pause and put on your gloves, because the work is just beginning.
Monday warrior, me's right. Today's Tom Sawyer, me's right.
It's time to turn the conversation to taking back America. From the crusaders who have drained our treasury, created needless wars, and would expect the working people to pay for their billionaires' gains, it's time for the Bruce Birch Radio Program. Brought to you by the West Virginia Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. They are building the American dream each and every day. You can get in on the program by dialing in to 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. And now, your host, Bruce Birch.
All right, welcome to the Bruce Birch Radio Program, radio for a free America. Glad to have you on board the Head On Radio Network today. It's Friday, and, you know, we've got a lot of good stuff in store for you today, including our this is the close of our second week on the air here at the Bruce Birch Radio Program. I'm really grateful, first of all, to all the folks out there who are avid listeners of the Head On Radio Network. Very, very grateful to have you with us, because we're building community here. You know, we're building a community where we all have a say. We all can get in on the conversation and create a new conversation here in the United States of America. Today I've got on the program with me, a little bit later on, I'll have Wayne Madsen of WayneMadsenReport.com, and we're going to be talking about a few more things. It turns out he's got some interesting tidbits about the whole Laura Bush Mayflower Hotel situation, as well as the fact that there was a neocon banker that committed suicide. He committed suicide, used a shotgun, right, in the back of the head, no less. So we're going to talk about that and a couple of other things with Wayne. Wayne has agreed to come on with us every Friday and talk about the tidbits that are going on in D.C., and the previous week, and, you know, what's going to be the conversation for the upcoming week as well. So, you know, good to have him. It'll be good to have him with us here today. And, I just wanted, before I get too far into the program, wanted to remind you that Ben Birch is still doing his donation or his fundraiser, I should say, over at the WhiteRoseSociety.org. Ben archives this program and all of the other Head On Radio Network programs, as well as a lot of other stuff, you know, Mike Malloy's show that he does over there, Mike Malloy and, Tom Hartman, all these wonderful progressive talk radio hosts that Ben archives. You can find those at WhiteRoseSociety.org. He's now having a fundraiser. Do the right thing. Head over there, drop a few bucks if you get the chance. It is Friday. It's payday, right? Instead of buying two lattes this weekend, save that $10. And do an online donation there, because without those donations, our good friend Ben Birch would have to close up shop, and you and I wouldn't have the entertainment that we're so used to having. So please do that if you can. Also, we're chatting in the Head On Radio Network chat room at headonradionetwork.com. You can go to the headonradionetwork.com homepage. Look for live chat on the left-hand side of the page. Click that. If you haven't ever been there, it'll make you register a little bit, but, you know, it's not a problem. We don't do anything with your name. It sits there. No spam email from us. We won't send you anything crazy. Go ahead and register, and that'll get you right into the chat room where the finest minds on the internets are chatting away. Let's see who's in there. We got a few people in there, about six or seven people in there at this point. That'll probably build in a little bit as the show goes on. Also, if you want to send me an email, you can do that by sending it to bruce@brucebirch.com. bruce@brucebirch.com, and Birch is spelled with a U. So if you send it to bruce@brucebirchtree, it won't come to me. It's got to go to the Bruce Birch guy. Now, my website is also there at brucebirch.com. You can check that out. Today I didn't quite get a show post up. I'll be working on it throughout the show. Maybe it'll be a show in review a post show post, post show post, post. Anyway, also we have a number of different stories that are cooking on the back burner, cooking there on the back burner for today. It appears apparently that the Democrats are prepared and are about to hold some oversight hearings on Iraq pre-war intelligence. Apparently, the Downing Street memo reporter is going to be joining the Democrats to do this. The Senate Democratic Policy Committee will be holding a special oversight hearing on pre-war intelligence related to Iraq on Monday. This is from rawstory.com. Wonderful source of news, by the way. Quote, if we're going to get things right when it comes to Iran, North Korea, and other national security threats, we need to learn what went wrong in the case of Iraq. DPC, the Democratic Policy Committee Chairman, Senator Byron Dorgan, Democrat of North Dakota, said in a statement today. The hearing is not an official congressional hearing. Of course not, because, you know, the Republicans don't want the truth to come out. They want the lies to continue to be propagated, the propaganda continuing to be catapulted. The hearing is not going to be an official congressional hearing, which, of course, must be convened with Republican support. It does, however, mark an aggressive step by Democrats to bypass the usual channels for intelligence oversight, namely the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, which remain mired in partisan disputes. Well, I would say they don't remain, they're not mired in partisan disputes. What they're mired in is the chest deep bullcrap of the Bush administration. The chest deep bullcrap of the Bush administration. Now, seriously, I mean, look at who's in charge of these committees, right? I think Pat Roberts is the Intelligence Committee Chair, Republican of Kansas. This is a guy, if he saw some truth, he would run the other way. All right, and when I say truth, I really mean facts. Anyway, that's the one story that's going to be happening on Monday. We'll be talking about that probably Monday afternoon. Hopefully we'll have some audio we can play to you then. The full list of witnesses here, you can get this at rawstory.com, but the full list of witnesses as listed on the DPC press release is, first witness is Lawrence Wilkerson, Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell, 2001 to 2005. Paul Pillar, CIA official responsible for coordinating intelligence on Iraq, 2000 to 2005. Carl Ford, the Assistant Secretary of State for Intelligence and Research, 2001 to 2003. Wayne White, State Department of Principal Iraq Analyst, 2003 to 2005. Rod Barton, Senior Advisor to the Iraq Survey Group, 2003 to 2004. And Michael Smith, reporter for the Sunday Times of London and the first to report the existence of the so-called Downing Street Memo, and Joseph Cirincione, co-author of WMD in Iraq, Evidence and Implications. So looking at the list right here, these aren't a bunch of Democrats, folks. These are a bunch of folks who actually were in the government when the decisions were being made about intelligence on Iraq. Now, these may have been dissenting officials. They may have been officials who said, you know what, we don't think this is the right thing to do, but anyway, yeah, so, you know, but they are people who were in the administration. These are people who were in the administration. So I would like to forward that information along to you. You can check that out on rawstory.com. Now, you know, one of the other thing that sort of stood out to me today is the fact that, a survey came out. And this is something that sort of relates directly to what we're doing here on the Horn. A survey came out that says that Americans' circle of close friends is shrinking. Apparently, according to this study, nearly a quarter of people surveyed said that they had zero close friends with whom to discuss personal matters. More than 50% named two or fewer confidants, most often immediate family members, the researchers said. Duke University professor Lynn Smith-Levin says this is a big social change that indicates something that is not good for our society. I cannot agree with her more. We've got to build more community. We've got to build more community, less separatism and more inclusiveness. That's the liberal way. It's about being inclusive. It's about building community together, not separately. Okay? All right. It looks like to me that we've got to head over to a break. So this is Bruce Birch on the Head On Radio Network. I'm broadcasting live from an undisclosed location on Elm Street in Greensboro, North Carolina. Great to have you with us. Happy Friday. Woohoo! After 5. We'll be right back.
To start to mold a new reality closer to the heart, closer to the heart. Blacksmith and the artist reflected in their art, they forge their creativity closer to the heart. Yes, closer to the heart.
Hey, how you doing? Got a quick question.
Yeah?
Who was Rudolf Nureyev?
Rudy Nureyev.
Rudy.
Okay, I know this one.
Good.
Wasn't he that... Nureyev?
Nureyev.
Wasn't he a defenseman for the Maple Leafs? Sure about that? Could have been a goalie.
Yeah. Hey, hi. How you doing? Who was Louis Armstrong?
That's easy. He was the first guy on the moon.
Really?
You know... One small step for man.
Sure, one giant leap for Louis. Hey, young lady.
Uh-huh.
Does the name Caravaggio mean anything to you?
Wasn't he the guy that went out with that mob guy's sister until he got whacked?
You know, no.
Are your kids as well-rounded as they could be? Kids who participate in the arts do better in school and in life. To learn more about the value of arts education, visit AmericansForTheArts.org. Because all kids should get to appreciate Nureyev's dance, Armstrong's horn, and Caravaggio's brush. Art. Ask for more. A public service message brought to you by Americans for the Arts and the Ad Council.
Once upon a time in a small cottage lived a boy named Chuck. One day, Chuck heard a knock from inside the wall.
Who is it?
He cried, for Chuck cried rather easily.
It is I, the energy hog, over here,
said a voice. Now, an energy hog is what you have when people waste energy. Chuck ran to tell his family.
There's a hog in our house!
Exclaimed Chuck.
That's no way to talk about your Aunt Melba,
said his mother, and sent him to his room.
That does it,
said Chuck. He raced to his computer and logged on to energyhog.org.
I'll just have to get rid of it myself.
At energyhog.org, Chuck played cool games and learned to use energy wisely. He learned that by switching to better light bulbs, he had the power to rid the cottage of the evil energy hog forever.
I'm leaving, but I shall return,
vowed the hog.
Don't count on it, bacon breath,
vowed Chuck. And the moral of the story is, to use energy wisely, log on to energyhog.org, or a switch in time, save swine.
This public service message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Energy and the Ad Council.
Want to fight childhood asthma? Then fight it with a scrub brush and a hot soapy towel. Even in the neatest and tidiest homes, if there's so much as a crumb to eat or a drop to drink, household pests like bugs and mice will do all that they can to get it. Creepy crawlies like bugs and mice are unpleasant enough as it is, but they're more than just a nuisance for kids with asthma because they can actually trigger an asthma attack. So, give them a whole lot of nothing. Sweep up crumbs, wipe down tables, scrub dishes before they pile up in the sink, and store leftovers in plastic bags or bowls. Don't leave them so much as one tidbit or nibble, and you can stop a childhood asthma attack before it starts. Discover other simple ways to prevent an asthma attack. Call 1-866-NO-ATTACKS or visit noattacks.org, because no child should feel like a fish out of water. A public service message brought to you by the U.S. EPA, the Ad Council, and this station.
Yeah.
right. You're back on the Bruce Burch Radio Program, Radio for a Free America, right here on the Head On Radio Network. We have a bunch of great programming here on the Head On Radio Network. Building community, one listener at a time. Now, I wanted to, before, I went out when I was talking about this story, this situation about people not having people close to them, and I think this really is highly indicative of the kind of situation that we have in our country today, is that, you know, the Bush administration and the Republicans and those on the right side of the aisle, you know, they want us to feel separated. They want us to feel isolated. They want us to feel like there's no one to turn to. There's no one to trust. And I'll tell you why they want us to feel that way, why they want us to think that way. The reason why they want us to think that way and the reason why they want us to feel that way is because when we feel isolated, we will turn to an authoritative figure for safety and security. And who is the authoritative figure? Anyone care to guess? That's right. The Bush administration. Now, this is not a far-fetched idea. I mean, it's a basic psychological tenet. If you feel insecure, unsafe, unable to trust anyone, you know, you will allow others to make security and safety for you. All right. And all of this comes from a lack of community. We are feeling more and more isolated. Yesterday on the radio program, I talked to Bob from North Dakota. He called in. He talked about what it was like growing up there in North Dakota and being able to go out on his porch at night and somebody would bring a guitar out and the next person would bring a violin or a fiddle, whichever you want to call it. We call it fiddle here in North Carolina, by the way. You know, and people would dance and they'd play music and they would create. One little word that I think we are lacking sorely right now, community. Roosevelt, way back when, talked about community. You know, we had in World War II the opportunity as a nation to collectively sacrifice, to collectively put something into the war effort, to feel like we had a stake in the process, to feel like, yes, we as American citizens believed in this struggle, and so therefore, because we were one nation, united, it was our job, just as much as it was the guys who went off to war, it was our job on the home front to support their efforts. Now, we've never been asked by this administration to do that. We've never been asked to pay a war tax. We've never been asked to create a victory garden. We've never been asked to ration gasoline or rubber products, because I think that was a big issue during World War II. We've never been asked to sacrifice one damned thing since this war began on the 19th of March, 2003. Not one thing. And that is shameful, ladies and gentlemen. It is very shameful that this president and that this Congress and that this this current government, which is run completely by the right wing now, they have nothing to fuss about because they're in charge. It's shameful that they haven't come to us and said, you know what, we really believe in this, or said, you know, will you sacrifice? Now, of course, we can always say, no, we won't sacrifice, because, you know, fully more than half of the American public right now believe we should get our, you know, cojones out of Iraq and other body parts. But we've never even been given the opportunity to do that. We've never been told or asked, would you please have something, you know, or do something to sacrifice? And I just find that completely deplorable, because we live in a day and age when I believe that had people been given the proper information about this this whole entire war, you know, we might have been able to stop it. You know, but they tried to make the evidence so overwhelming, and it's coming back to bite them right now. I mean, you know, talked to you about a few minutes ago, the Senate Intelligence, the Oversight Committee, there's going to have, the Democratic part of that committee is going to have their own Oversight Committee. And, you know, too little too late, perhaps? I don't know. Henry Waxman's been doing that job the entire freaking time. John Conyers has been gathering evidence the entire time. You know, all these guys are waiting for is us to elect them into power so that they can take care of business the way it needs to be taken care of and hold these bastards accountable. It's shameful that we are in a situation in Iraq like we are. Now, I don't blame one bit of this on any of those soldiers, so don't get me wrong here. I am absolutely in support of the troops. I believe very strongly that these veterans who are coming back from this war, you know, who are given surveys to see whether or not they have PTSD, you know, oh, by the way, if you say yes to any of these questions, we're going to hold you for treatment for 3 days and you're not going to be able to see your family for three more days. That's what they tell them coming back. You know, that's a direct quote from a returning Iraqi vet that I've already talked to. So they're not going to self-disclose whether or not they have post-traumatic stress disorder, because if they do that, then it requires them to be away from their family. And who wants to be away from their family? They want to come home and see their wife and their kids, and they want to go to parties, and they want to barbecue in the backyard, and they want to crack a beer, and they want to do all the things that they want, you know, to do. And I got to tell you, it is absolutely deplorable that we have put them in a situation where they have to, choose between answering truthfully on a questionnaire and seeing their family. Those veterans are not going to get the proper treatment. They're going to go home and they're going to say, you know what, I don't know that I need to go back to the VA. I don't think I need to go back and do this questionnaire. I can handle it. You know, and then 2 or 3 months later, they start having nightmares. 2 and 3 months later, you know, loud noises begin to freak them out. 2 and 3 months later, they start isolating and they don't want to have friends because they can trust no one but their buddy who was blown up in an IED next to them one day in Iraq. 2 or 3 months later, they're not wanting to seek treatment because nobody understands. And that's the sad thing about what's going on in the military and going on in the Department of VA right now, is that these guys aren't getting the treatment they need to get. And it's up to us to build the right kind of community to support them, to create the kind of community that those guys know when they get back they're getting support. You know what? You support the troops, you put a little yellow magnet thing on your car, well, you know what? You support the troops, bring them home. You support the troops, push the administration to fund the VA the way it needs to be funded. Make PTSD treatment a priority, not a tertiary expense, but a priority expense. That's the kind of support that we're looking for. That's the kind of support that we need to be giving to these soldiers, because they come back and they're being confused by these various instruments of destruction. Yes, you know what? I'm starting out on the show a little bit angry today. That's okay though, because you know what? Some of these things need to be said, and you know, and we're not hearing them enough. We're not hearing, you know, well, you know what? Y'all are cut and run. No, actually what we're trying to do is face reality. We're trying to realize, we're trying to show the rest of the world that the United States of America can own its mistakes and do the right thing eventually. We're trying to show them. But the Republican Party, you know, for so long, it's been ingrained in them that you never admit a mistake. See, that's what Nixon did, man. He shouldn't have never admitted to that mistake there in Watergate. He should never have done it. If he'd just lied his way through it, everything would have been fine. That's what a lot of people would like to make you believe. If they just tell lies, if they just cover up, if they don't tell the truth, if they just pretend that the mistakes that they made weren't real mistakes, we're still trying to make, you know, if they just pretend that, they think it's going to go away. Well, I'm here to tell you that I'm not going to let it happen. If anything, this radio program will definitely hold them accountable. You're listening to the Bruce Birch radio program on the Head On Radio Network. I'm your host, Bruce Birch, and if you want to get in on the show a little bit later on, please do so. I'd like to have you back on at the top of the hour. I've got Wayne Madsen coming up next as a guest here on the program. We're trying to keep him on every Friday. So please do dial in 1-877-443-2366. If you want to send me an email, I'd be glad to receive it. Bruce at brucebirch.com. It's Bruce Birch on the Head On Radio Network.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can now grab as a podcast or download off our website over at progressive.org. George Bush has had one success in office. He succeeded in tarnishing the U.S. image abroad. A new study by the Pew Global Attitudes Project shows a distressing decline over the last 6 years. The favorability ratings of the U.S. fell in Indonesia, the most populous Muslim country in the world, from 75% to 30%. In Turkey, from 52% to 12%, and we give Turkey a ton of aid. In Egypt, another Muslim country that gets a lot of U.S. aid, only 30% approve of George Bush's America. In Jordan, only 15%. Even our allies in what Donald Rumsfeld so callously called old Europe have begun to shun us. Our rating in Great Britain fell from 83% to 56%. In France, from 62% to 39%. In Germany, from 78% all the way down to 37%. And in Spain, it fell from 50% to less than half, 23%. So if you're planning on going to Europe or the Middle East this summer, don't expect to be greeted warmly. And you can blame your chilly reception on George Bush and on his Iraq war and on his arrogant attitude and his disdain for international law. No one likes a bully. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
The United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Millwrights meet your most complex needs by providing productivity, competitiveness, reliability, accuracy, safety, leadership, and professionalism. Millwrights from the United Brotherhood of Carpenters are problem solvers. They accept any challenge and approach every project with the highest of competence and training. The UBC has thousands of professionals who can be at your service, giving you the best in business, anytime and every time. The Head On Radio Network is proud to be sponsored by these wonderful men and women who are building the American dream every day. Thank you from the Head On Radio Network. There's one place on the web you can go that's so topical, you can apply it liberally. WD40.com. WDYAD40.com. Wad Wally and Dookie are there. They're working hard every day to give you updates in news, politics, and a great sense of humor. Just stop on by and see the boys at WD40.com, a place where you can raise your voice and be heard. WD40.com. Your one-stop shop for all things progressive.
I can feel no sense of measure, no illusions as we take refuge in young man's pleasure, breaking down the dreams we made.
Back with Bruce Birch on the Head On Radio Network, the Bruce Birch radio program. I guess we're having a little bit of a tough time with our guests this week. I don't know. Now, Wayne Madsen, who was going to be on the program right at 5:30, has decided, or we're trying to get a hold of him. So what we're going to do is go ahead and take a caller. I believe we have Jim on line one. Let's go ahead and take that call, and we'll see if we can bring Wayne on a little bit later. Jim, are you there?
I'm here. It's just Sweetie. How are you?
How are you today, sir?
Very well. Very well.
Good to have you back.
Thank you. Enjoyed yesterday tremendously. It was a gas. It was indeed.
But it was a hoot.
It's a hoot. Absolutely. But today's more serious stuff, and this is something I just want to share with you, okay?
Sure.
And this has to do with this young lieutenant who is decided not to deploy to Southwest Asia. And I've been thinking about this, and it's really bothered me, because, Bruce, I've had to take that oath four or five times. And in that oath, it says in there, to uphold the Constitution, but also it has in there, without purpose of evasion. Now, just hear me out here, because we may have to agree to disagree on this, okay?
Okay.
If I were this young man, I think I would have either have gone in the Air Force or the Navy. I mean, I've been blue, I've been green. And believe me, blue is much better, okay?
Okay.
When he went green, he guaranteed his certainty of being deployed to Southwest Asia, almost without a doubt. And he knew what he was doing. I heard the man. He's very well-spoken, very intelligent. And he knew what he was doing when he was taking that oath. And when he then further went to OCS, he was further inculcated into what the military wanted of him. And when you take an oath, now, I don't know about you, but what is an oath but words that we say to God, okay? And when a man takes an oath, it's like holding yourself in your own hands like water. And if you open your fingers, then you need not hope to find yourself again. And some men aren't capable of this, but I would be loath to think myself one of them. And I have problems with what he's doing. I really do. And I feel like that he basically, when he signed that 4-1 and that DA form 10-1066, is the initial part of his 201 file. He knew what he was going to have to do, and he accepted the benefits and this, that, and the other. Now, I realize that, you know, there are people who argue about the oath that George Bush took and the things that are going on over there. This is true. But as far as the taking of the oath itself and then reneging upon it, that gives me great consternation. I have problems with that. I do. And if I were sitting on the courts martial board, I would have a serious problem with this young man.
Well, he certainly made an oath, Jim. I think that, you know, this is a large debate. I actually had a conversation with another veteran the other day about this off the air. And his calculation of the situation is very similar to your calculation in that, you know, the man took an oath and he's got to uphold it. And you know, if for some reason he's allowed out of this, you know, then basically that opens the door to anarchy in the military.
And we can't have that.
Now,
we cannot have
But before I understand that, but let's do one thing. If it's possible for a moment,
okay,
separate the fact that, you know, he's going to get court-martialed, and then we'll probably go serve prison time over this, and we'll probably make an example from the act that he took.
Mm-hmm.
Would you not agree with me that this was a courageous act?
Well, let me put it this way. You know, one of my greatest heroes is Sir Thomas More. You know,
okay.
Are you familiar with Sir Thomas?
Yes.
Okay. Now, he was put into the Tower of London, and they asked him to take an oath so that he could come out. And that oath, part of that oath entailed him swearing allegiance to King Henry VIII, and the marriage and basically denying his Catholic faith. He would not do that. All he had to do was to have signed that oath. And he could have come out and gone home to Chelsea. Instead, he went to the block. So, and there is the man who, in my opinion, really knew the honor of what it was to take an oath and was willing to put his head on the block for it. And that's the only way I can answer you. And I would like to join you for fellowship's sake, in a way, I guess, in the way you think, in a way a lot of these other people on this network think. But, Bruce, and I realize I come across a lot of times as being very frivolous, and I am frivolous, but there are parts of me that are very serious.
Sure.
And, you know, but to join you for fellowship's sake would be to not do my conscience. And when you are allowed into heaven for doing your conscience, and I am sent to hell for not doing my conscience, would you join me for fellowship's sake?
I think that we need to act in such a way that we can sleep at night, Jim. And, you know, if that means that this gentleman, you know, refuses his orders and does what he feels is the right and necessary thing to do, that is his choice. And, you know, whether it's right or wrong, that's a choice he's making.
Yeah, that's right.
And apparently it's the one that he's most comfortable with, you know. Now, you know, again, I've talked to guys who would feel like this is completely wrong, and I've talked to guys who said that this is a very courageous thing to do. I think there's a lot of different viewpoints on what he's doing.
Absolutely.
If he's doing nothing else, he's creating a conversation.
Oh, definitely that.
Which needs to occur. Would you not agree with that?
It does need to occur, and it does need to make people realize that when you do take an oath, that you do hold yourself, you do hold yourself in your own hands like water, and you should heed the seriousness of taking that oath, or you should not take it. That is one of the lessons of it. It's certainly it is not lost upon me. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to say,
his situation is his situation. I am wholeheartedly against this war, as I know that you are, too. We've talked about it.
I am. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a terrible war. We were led into it under false circumstances. And the men who are leading at the top are less than honorable men. And I hope that if we can take the Congress back, that we can open up investigations and to bring these people down and to place them in positions of where they're going to be punished.
Right.
And that is my ultimate wish. And I hate to see this young man thrown into the sausage grinder. I hate to see it. But, you know, I have to look at things bilaterally. You know, you got to look at things both ways. And that's what I've tried to do, okay?
Sure.
And I
would like to think that I've tried to as well. I really do think, though, that the conversation has been stepped up a notch by his action. And I think that in and of itself is, you know, going to have interesting effects. Now, whether that's going to be positive or negative effects for him personally, he's going to go to the clink, and we both know that, you know, and he knows that too.
He could be going to Kansas and not with red shoes, that's for sure,
and not with red shoes. Well, and you know what, Jim, I think as the story unfolds, it'll be interesting to see how this gets played out.
Pardon me?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, and believe you me, I take no pleasure in that.
Right.
I don't. I hate to see a young life ruined.
Well, it's definitely sparking another level of conversation about what's going on with this war, or this occupation, I should say. So I think we definitely need to, that by itself, I think, is a positive effect. But there's also negative ones as well. So, Jim, I'm going to have to go because I've got my guest on the other line, and we need to go ahead and bring him on and talk about the shenanigans in D.C.
Oh, I've lived there. There are plenty of those going on there, let me tell you. That's the shenanigan town.
There you go.
Have a nice weekend.
I certainly will, Jim, and you do as well, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay, let's hope.
Okay. And that's our good friend, Jim, from an undisclosed location in West Virginia. Now, you know, we're going to go ahead and cut our break because I want to get Wayne in here. Maybe he can hold over the top of the hour too. We'll see. Our good friend from WayneMadsenReport.com, who is an investigative journalist and just wrote a book called Jaded Tasks, which is available at Amazon and other places near you. Our good friend Wayne Madsen is on the line. Wayne, how are you doing today, man?
Great. Good to be with you.
Good to have you with me. Now you're out and about today, running down some leads, eh?
Well, it's still some residual effects of the story about the president and the Secretary of State. I found it extremely unusual that the First Lady, while she was on the state visit to Vienna, Austria, had to tell a group of foreign exchange students about what happens when she and the president wake up at 5:30 in the morning, that he leaves and goes and brings her coffee. I found, in light of the recent news about their rocky relationship, that was an extremely unusual a peek into the early morning activities of the first couple.
Really? Well, these guys, I mean, you know, now, just to sort of bring people up to speed who don't know, the president's wife stayed a few nights at a hotel recently, right?
At the Mayflower Hotel here in Washington. It's about four blocks from the White House. There has been additional journalists, have been additional journalists who have called the Mayflower. The word there is that it's a very a touchy subject. People, when they're asked, are extremely nervous, and obviously the word is out that there is no word on the Mayflower's involvement in at least one night she stayed there with their Secret Service detail, possibly as many as three nights.
Wow. Now, this was about an alleged tryst or an affair with Bush and Condi, right?
That's right, and apparently this relationship is not a new one. It, from people I know who were familiar with the first Bush, H.W. Bush administration, W. of course was served as his father's sort of gopher and hatchet man. Remember, it was W. Bush who was the person who actually fired H.W. Bush's chief of staff at the time, John Sununu. But apparently W. Bush and Condoleezza Rice go back to that administration where she was a senior official within the National Security Council. So this isn't a new thing. It's a rather old relationship, which apparently has grown even much closer than it was back in the administration of his father.
Now, you run down some leads today. Anything new besides what you just told me?
Well, there's what the First Lady said in Austria is drawing a lot of attention because she has been a fairly private person about their private life, and it. There's a lot of speculation that she was window dressing to put to rest what is now starting to appear in the various tabloids and being mentioned more and more on radio programs around the country. So that's the speculation here right now. But it's certainly, I mean, this is, of course, a salacious story, but we know from the Clinton administration these were the stories that were used by the right wing to hound him into impeachment eventually. But there's more going on in Washington. I think the WMD story is probably one of the bigger developments this week.
Okay, yeah, so let's talk about that.
Well, of course, we had the Senator from Pennsylvania, Rick Santorum, with the House Intelligence Committee Chairman Peter Hoekstra of Michigan, having this news conference where they were crowing about, we found the WMDs, we found them, the Democrats were wrong, those in opposition to the war were wrong. Of course, this was picked up by Fox News. People like Hannity went with this. Well, essentially, and I've got a story up on my website today, one of the people with the military intelligence battalion, Army counterintelligence, who served in Iraq, did discover old bombs and the residue of nerve agents. He was shown this by an officer in the Iraqi intelligence, and it turns out that when he was shown this individual, Dave DeBato, when he was shown the paperwork, he was surprised to see that it was in English, and also saw that this WMD components were delivered in 1988 during the height of the Iran-Iraq war by the United States. We know that Donald Rumsfeld was the envoy for Reagan that negotiated this deal, and written on the documents was the Carlyle Group as the originator of these WMD components. They were shipped from Spain via France into Iraq.
Well, wow. You know, I just can't help it, but, you know, you dig up the damnedest stuff, Wayne.
Well, I think this goes to show that, you know, when the joke about Rumsfeld saying, remember, well, he made this comment, we know where the WMDs are, they're north of Tikrit, east of Tikrit, and the joke was, of course, Rumsfeld knows that Saddam has the WMDs because Rumsfeld has the receipts. Well, it turns out that probably isn't so much of a joke, that there's a lot of truth to that. To that comment, that it was Rumsfeld, of course, who met with Saddam Hussein in 1984 and worked out this deal where the U.S. would supply Iraq with these deadly weapons, chemical weapons and biological weapons, so he could use them on the Iranians. Hello?
Still here. Hold on.
Hello?
Yes, Wayne?
Yes.
Hold on 1 second.
Wayne, are you still with me?
Yes, I'm here.
Sorry, I just had, I'm calling back in on the telephone line because I just lost my power here.
Okay.
we had a rip snorting thunderstorm just blow through here in North Carolina.
Well, we had one here in Washington last night. I have to say, I've lived in this town since 1982, and I have never witnessed such a long period of thunder and lightning. It lasted for hours, and of course, it was in the wee hours of the morning, And you know, I've talked to people who've lived in this town longer, and they had not seen anything like it either. So I think Al Gore was, of course, right when he said that the weather was going to get more and more extreme because of what we found out today about this being the warmest year since in 2,000 years on this planet.
Well, I totally think so. I mean, and I've seen a lot of that here too. Just the thunderstorms have gotten more severe and more intense. Hail, you know, two or three times in one day, which is unheard of, really, or just not that often. I wanted to ask you, tell me about, the banker that you had written about on your website. That I was really interested in that story. I read that he had ties to some very interesting organizations.
Well, Phil Merrill was the publisher of a number of newspapers in Maryland, and also the Washingtonian magazine. The wealthy individual also was a donor to a lot of neoconservative think tanks. Also, the journalism school at the University of Maryland is named after him because he made a huge donation to that place. And I wrote, even before they found his body, that based on people I had spoken to about his time when he was appointed by Dick Cheney to be the head of the U.S. Export-Import Bank, that he was at the bank during the time questionable loans were made to the Coalition Provisional Authority that was headed up by Paul Bremer. Now we know that $9 billion is missing that was in the hands of the Coalition Provisional Authority. Some of that money came via letters of credit and loans from the Exim Bank, the Export-Import Bank, which Merrill headed up from 2002 to 2005. Merrill's also a very close friend of Dick Cheney, who obviously was the guy who arranged for Merrill to head up the Export-Import Bank. I think with all, you know, this money that's missing, I wrote even before they found the body that don't be surprised if not foul play, and now we found out that in fact it wasn't an accident, and they're claiming it was suicide, but the guy was found with an anchor chain around his ankle.
If you'd like to make a call, please hang up.
Hello?
Wayne, are you still there?
Yes, I'm here.
Evidently, their phone system has gone out also.
Yeah, it sounded.
I take it that they're having some technical difficulty due to the thunderstorms.
Like having thunderstorms there, and they're losing their power, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of nasty.
Right.
We hope to hear from you again.
No problem. No problem.
And thank you so much for hold on, maybe that's Bruce.
Oh, okay. Hello?
Wayne, hey, I'm sorry, Wayne. This is just...
I am here. I understand. The power is a problem there.
This is an interesting situation. First time that I've ever had the cell phone go off or go completely blank when a lightning strike was nearby. It's a trip. I heard you talking, and then the lightning hit, and then you weren't there. And I was like, oh, my goodness.
I don't know how much I said about the Merrill case before I lost the connection, but
well, actually, what I picked up, I got to the point where you about the bank and the
export bank.
We seem to still be having some technical difficulty, okay?
Doesn't sound good.
Okay. Wayne, as I said, I hope you call in again.
Oh, no problem.
And thank you for being here today.
Okay. Okay. I hope that storm goes through there.
Thank you so much. We appreciate that.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye now.
This is the Quality News Network. In Miami, seven men have been indicted for homegrown terrorism, including a plot to blow up the Sears Tower in Chicago and other federal buildings to, quote, kill all the devils we can. The leader of the group allegedly contacted Al-Qaeda to help them with funding and supplies. A report in the New York Times today says the Treasury Department has been obtaining information on international financial transactions since September 11th. To track the flow of terrorist money. Today, Treasury Secretary John Snow defended the program as an important source of information. The Iraqi government imposed a curfew today and declared a state of emergency following a firefight with insurgents outside of the heavily fortified Green Zone in Baghdad. Across Iraq, at least 17 people were killed in violent attacks that included an explosion outside of a Sunni mosque. Also in Baghdad, the Iraqi government is expected to announce on Sunday a national reconciliation package to keep the country from falling into civil war. According to the UK Times Online, to win over the Sunnis, the proposal will offer amnesty to prisoners and include resistance groups in the political process. Many U.S. lawmakers are upset with the plan because of the offer for amnesty to insurgents who killed U.S. troops. In Saudi Arabia, six terrorist suspects were reportedly shot to death by Saudi security forces in the capital. In southern Afghanistan, the U.S. military says coalition forces killed 17 insurgents in an enemy bunker. In the Pacific Ocean near Guam, the American military has concluded the largest war games exercise in decades. The Pentagon reports that an interceptor rocket fired from a U.S. warship successfully knocked down a short-range missile that was test-fired from Hawaii. In Tokyo, the United States and Japan have agreed to expand their joint ballistic missile defense shield. The agreement was worked out before the current threat from North Korea that it may test launch a long-range missile. The mayor of San Jose, the nation's 10th largest city, has been arrested on bribery charges. However, he says he won't resign. In Washington, Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta will leave his post next month. He's the only Democrat in the president's cabinet. A new sociology study finds that Americans are more isolated socially than they were 20 years ago. The results show more people say they have no one in whom they can confide. You're listening to the Quality News Network.
Divorce is never a pleasant experience, but it doesn't have to be a tragedy. If you can rein in the emotions, step back from the anger and victimhood, you can end your marriage with dignity instead of hostility. You married with the best of intentions. Now you need to untie the marital knot with the same mutual respect. Choose collaboration instead of confrontation. Stop wasting money on lawyers. Don't drag this out for 5 years. A collaborative divorce is better for the children, family, and friends. Collaboration costs a fraction of a contended divorce and can be done within weeks rather than the months or years. An award-winning documentary called Divorce Collaborative Style explains how you can end your marriage fairly and efficiently. For less than what a lawyer charges to answer one simple question, you can get all the answers from Divorce Collaborative Style. Go to collaborativedivorce.tv and order your DVD today. If it's over, end it right. collaborativedivorce.tv.
The first nuclear power plants to be built in the U.S. since 1973 will go up outside of Houston. Hitachi and General Electric have been chosen for the $5.2 billion project to build two nuclear reactors. Oil and natural gas producer Anadarko Petroleum is buying two of its smaller rivals. It is paying $21 billion for Kerr-McGee and Western Gas Resources. The United Auto Workers Union says about 40,000 hourly workers have accepted buyout and early retirement offers by GM and Delphi. That number exceeded their expectations. The Commerce Department reports that durable goods orders fell 0.3% in May. It's the second straight month of declines in big-ticket factory orders led by weak demand for commercial aircraft. Verizon Airphone announced it will stop its commercial airline phone service by the end of the year. The company wants to focus on its other businesses, including broadband, cellular, and television. Netflix, the online video rental company, is reportedly investing $5 to $10 million in digital download technology. The company that pioneered DVD rentals through the mail indicates that method may soon be outdated. And despite speculation that the new owners of Lord & Taylor would sell off the flagship Fifth Avenue store in New York, they are saying it will stay in place. Light sweet crude settled at $70.87 a barrel today, and at the close of Wall Street this week, the Dow was down 30 points, the Nasdaq down 1 point. There's more at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Allie Dramoff.
It's time for another hour of conversation radio on the Head On Radio Network. Where the callers are the experts. You're back with the Bruce Birch Radio Program. With your host, Bruce.
All right, you're back to the Bruce Birch Radio Program, and we are having a few technical difficulties, but we're waiting on Bruce. So in the meantime, we have an interview on family scheduled for you, and we hope you enjoy it.
At the heart of our project is a study that has never been done before. We looked at a week in the life of 32 families where both parents work outside the home at least 30 hours. We videotaped how families were interacting with each other from the moment they woke up in the morning to the moment the kids went to bed at night. Be successful in our work. Work so long, and also managed to have a family life. We put together a team of anthropologists, clinical psychologists,
education scientists and linguists to understand the family as an integrated system. Archaeologists are used to digging in the ground and just, you know, hoping and praying that they're going to find a few shards and to be able to put together, you know, some artifacts. When they started doing this project, they were overwhelmed with the amount of stuff inside people's homes. The program is sponsored by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. We have a digital lab. We have a server that is chock full of video data, archaeological data, photographs, and tracking information on where family members are every 10 minutes during the day. Some families are taking their kids to two or three activities every single day. That's a lot of running around. There are some families who are marvelous at doing all these different activities and they thrive on those activities. But for other families, the families are run ragged.
We're coming to get you now.
Where are we going?
We're going to hockey.
So 16 times 4,000.
Okay.
64,000.
A lot of physical skills get acquired by going through structured activities, but children have very little downtime. We filmed here in Los Angeles, but we feel that results are actually characteristic of this country as a whole. All over the United States, not just in the families we studied, there is a cultural assumption which associates unstructured time with something negative, but we need unstructured time just to be able to bring up something spontaneously, informally, with other family members. We're a very child-centered society. What's happened now is that we have gone beyond being a child-centered society to being a child-dominated society. Women are carrying much more of the household labor than men. Our study found that women are not assuming this burden without complaint. There are really three jobs that working parents have. Jobs at the workplace, then they have the extra job of having a family. The family is the heartbeat of the nation. If we don't have strong families, we don't have a strong nation.
to the metal man. Now that it's time to leave the ground and maybe try to understand.
Here at the at another installment of the Cricketers Lecture Series here with Professor of Economics Steve Keen. And tonight you gave a really, really interesting lecture on Wowsernomics. And before I ask you to define Wowsernomics, we've had mostly political conversations here. And I did find it very, very interesting that you did not actually get into the political aspects of economics in the discussion at all. And that's just purely an observation.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of hope that you might explain why
mm-hmm.
on that. Was there a particular reason for that?
Yes, there is. It's because most critics of economics automatically identify with critics of the economic system. So if you're a critic of economic theory, you're normally regarded as being a critic of capitalism, which is the
right.
system about which we're being theoretical. My point is that conventional economic theory so completely misunderstands capitalism that it might as well be a description of the society of a bunch of Tyrannosaurus Rexes. It's so inappropriate to the world we live in. And therefore, we have to actually understand the system before we can even decide whether we like it or not.
Right.
And Marx once made the comment that philosophers have hitherto explained the world, the purpose is to change it. My argument is Marx got that wrong. Philosophers don't understand the world yet, and economists understand it less well than anybody. So I'm leaving the politics out. I simply want to say we have to get an accurate description of the system in which we live, and once we have that, then we can debate that, and therefore I leave the politics out of my commentary.
Okay. Because I was very surprised. I was expecting more political content,
mm-hmm.
and that's fine. And I understand your reasoning for doing that. And I think that's very interesting. Now, as I look down my notes, first we'll go straight to just for the Americans, please define Wowsernomics.
Okay. Well, it's me having a bit of fun with the language and being an Australian about it as well. Pardon the fact that I'm losing my voice here. But Australia used to have, and still has to some extent, a tradition we call larrikinism. And that's where you thumb your nose at authority. And of course, you can relate it back to the fact that we were convicts once. But of course, at the same time, to have convicts, you've got to have warders. And what the convicts would do behind the backs of the warders is thumb their nose at authority, send authority up.
Right.
So that's partly the tradition which runs in Australia, and it's still part of the Australian culture. It's why Crocodile Dundee appealed to Americans, for example, that particular spirit. Now, wowser is a term that the larrikins use to describe somebody who is religiously righteous, telling you how you should behave. And there are plenty of warders who are doing that. So you say, you bloody wowser. Wowser, wowser, wowser. And it was sending up the fact that most of these people, you look at them, though, they'd be really disgusted by something sensual. But at the same time, there's this underlying thing, you're turned on by this, aren't you? So a wowser is somebody who spouts religious conservatism, but in fact, underlying that, they're also titillated by it.
Right.
And that's a very common trend you find in people who are politically, religiously conservative, combination together, not one or the other.
Right.
The Rush Limbaughs of the world, and you didn't check up, and I don't know if Rush is one of them, but so many of the American evangelists have been quite literally defrocked.
I mean,
they deserve to be wowsed.
Rush is just a tool, as far as anyone can say, and I mean, I don't see how anyone can take that man seriously, considering the fact that he spent almost 20 years on radio claiming that anyone that got busted with 1 gram of marijuana should be locked up for life, when this guy was sending out his cleaning lady to go and score OxyContin off for him off of the black market.
Exactly what I'm talking about. The wowsers portray this proper exterior and often quite corrupt behind it. So that's why I use the wowser as a thing about economics. It appears to have a proper exterior, but inside it's totally corrupt.
Right.
That was a beautiful little analogy to twist in a way.
And it is beautiful. Now, one of the things that... There's a couple of things in the lecture that you hit on that struck me. First of all, as you described all of us here as witnesses, being here just to listen to you as heretics. And then there were the believers.
Mm.
Now, you've never heard our show, but one of the particular favorite turns of phrase that Bruce, my co-host, and I like to use is opposite world.
Opposite worlds?
Opposite worlds.
Mm-hmm.
That very much of what we observe in current politics, in the media, is portrayed as though it is the opposite of what it is.
Yes, okay.
Right? Mm-hmm. Current American environmental policy, the Clear Skies Initiative, the only thing it's clearing is the sky of birds, right? And to me, that plays, you're playing on that a bit. But why is it that those of us that doubt the system are, I mean, like, you describe us as heretics.
Mm.
Who is the heretic and who is the believer?
Well, it's a bit like the question, who is the terrorist and who's the enforcer of justice?
It's the perspective that it comes from?
It's the perspective it comes from. If you're standing outside it, then you're called a terrorist. You may become a freedom fighter if you're bringing about the changes that somebody in authority wants.
Right.
So a similar thing for people who stand outside economic theory, you're seen as the heretic. And probably the best expression I've seen of this, I've forgotten the author responsible for, but it's a wonderful line about economics. And he said that normally on any science, you'll have a fringe of lunatics. He said, in economics, you have lunatics and a fringe of sane people. The lunatics run the show, and there's a fringe of sane people on the outside criticizing it. So in that ironic sense, a heretic are the ones who believe in sound logical analysis. The people on the inside, the believers, think they're being logical, but in fact they've got one of the most illogical, badly conceived notions in the world. So your point about the world is quite apt for my attitude as well.
Well, you talked about bad mathematics as well.
Yeah.
Okay, now, I myself am an audio engineer,
yep.
You know, and so I've worked in the world of physics and
mathematics.
You've
done some fast Fourier transforms in your time.
Oh, and just the fact that there are certain rules to things, and for things to happen, other things will happen.
Yep.
There is cause and effect and whatnot. And when you and I first met 2 months ago,
yeah,
we had a little pre-discussion. I spoke about the gentleman who does the finance reports on the ABC.
Okay.
Remember I mentioned that for the first time, I was talking about that the ABC suddenly popped up at the sky.
Alan Kohler.
The gent, right? Mm. And he seems to put into effect in a very short period of time something that you brought up in your lecture,
mm.
which was economists tend to, the believers, mm. if I get this right, the believers try to maintain things in a perfect model.
Yeah.
Where you describe trying to balance a bicycle without any forward motion.
Yeah.
Right? This gentleman will throw out some statistics. The market did this. Raw materials did that, this or that, right?
Mm.
And the initial facts of that it's up or down have a black and white type of, I don't know, reaction mm-hmm. to them. Well, he then will usually bring in one or two other bits of information mm-hmm. into the circle, and without actually saying it, debunk the very thing that the singular fact
yes.
put out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I come from a land where, even if you don't get a chance to write out all the math,
mm-hmm.
there are certain rules that you know
mm-hmm.
inherently that you can't break.
Yeah.
I find the same thing in the way economics is discussed normally, aside from this guy.
Yeah.
Like, he's one of the rarities mm-hmm. that I actually see. He'll actually turn around and say how this, okay, it says that this went up. That sounds really good. But if mm-hmm. you are this and you are doing this, that mm-hmm. means it's costing you this. And it mm-hmm. isn't good.
Yeah.
But the guy who owns that yeah. industry
yeah.
is doing great.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that you mentioned that you seem to return in the lecture, and I really, really want our listeners to either check out the podcast or the webcast or download it,
mm-hmm.
They rely on singular factoids.
Yes.
Can you kind of explain how they're able? What? How does this end up twisting the facts? Can you elaborate on this?
There's at least two ways that it does. One is that what you like about Alan Kohler is effectively he's applying systems thinking to economics.
Right.
Okay. He's saying that there's a cause here which has an effect over there, but then there's a feedback.
Right.
And he analyzes the feedback. Now, most of neoclassical economics, consciously or unconsciously, has been designed to eliminate the feedback element, to have a direct cause and effect with no feedback concept. Because if you're in equilibrium, there is no feedback.
It's very easy to have things perfect when nothing's coming back at
you. Yeah, that's right. So you cut the feedback effect out. And what then happens is that's what they hope to achieve in their analysis. But when they really look deeply at it, they found that they couldn't eliminate the feedbacks. And the feedbacks had the opposite effect to what they wanted the overall direct system to be. And so you get these absurd assumptions that are made to neutralize the feedback effects. So, like, one of the classics is the simple notion of a demand curve, where they try to derive a downward-sloping demand curve for a market. And they say, okay, let's derive this from the individual consumer. So they start with a model of the individual consumer, which says that all the consumer wants is a particular combination of commodities. And they have a budget, a set of relative prices, and that determines what they can consume. And so long as you impose a set of fairly reasonable conditions, you can show that will let you derive a downward-sloping demand curve, meaning that if you want this person to consume more of a commodity, you've got to reduce the price. So this individual, you get a nice, well-behaved, as they call it, demand curve. Then they try to go from that to the overall market.
Right.
And they wave their hands and they do it and move on to the next step on the textbook. When you go back and look at the detailed analysis, which is the stuff that people like Sonnenschein and Schaefer and in a weird sort of way Gorman did, you find that they worked out that if you do have more than one person, you've got to also include income distribution in the system. And then if you change prices to work out what somebody might pay at a higher or lower price of bananas, you actually change income distribution. So that budget line that you're drawing, which for the single individual you keep one price fixed and move all the others, and you believe you can move prices without affecting income, in this case, you are actually changing income as well. So when you try to add up all those nice, well-behaved demand curves, you don't get a well-behaved market demand curve at all. You get a market demand curve that can have literally any shape whatsoever.
Right.
So that therefore means that the feedback effects overwhelm the direct effect you want to have come out. So what you do, if you're honest, is you abandon the theory. But if you're dishonest or you don't know the theory well enough, you think you can go smoothly from a single individual to the overall market. And it's that mendacity that I'm attacking.
So it feels to me like current accepted economic theory or play.
Yeah.
Revolves around basically a falsehood.
Yes.
And we're all trying to maintain that falsehood.
Often, a large part of those who believe the theory or believe it gives an explanation of reality don't actually know that there are falsehoods there.
Well, absolutely. It's unfortunately an ignorance because you've only been told this. You've only been told that it is this way, so you work on the assumption that this is how it's supposed to work,
right.
So you try and maintain
it. You know there may be a particular tricky bit,
right?
And you think that involves mathematics that's beyond you, and somebody else has done the mathematics, solved it, you've seen a paper published on the topic, you haven't actually read the paper, but you know the paper is there, you accept the logic is correct, and you can go on with a simplistic level of understanding, believing it's being supported. In fact, in virtually every case, those advanced articles have found that it isn't supported. Now, sometimes the authors honestly say that. People like Sonnenschein have largely left the academic fold because he's just realized that there was something wrong with his intellectual tradition. He's now an administrator, gives the occasional economics paper, but he's effectively left the profession. Others abandon it in the sense that Mark Lauck has done, though he was never a mathematical economist. People like Solo are starting to become bewildered by what they're finding being done around them. People like Samuelson have moved substantially from their position. But it tends to be that this only happens when a person reaches a certain level of age and maturity. And then what tends to happen is the young Turks come through, who've been fed all this stuff beforehand, and think, oh, the old bloke's going senile. And in fact, they don't pay respect to what the old ones are doing, and then the same thing perpetuates itself.
They end up taking the Fed theory with no practical application
and
continue on the cycle.
That's right.
Now, I'm going to finish up with something slightly off, and I've somehow avoided politics fairly well through this, which is probably good, because, I don't know, they necessarily shouldn't be intertwined the way that they are.
Mm.
You talked about moving currency across borders. Now, this is something that fascinates me, and I personally don't necessarily understand very well.
Mm-hmm.
But this has to be, to me, a massive game.
Mm.
And there has to be a constant flow of just moving the money from here to here, from there to here, for a certain amount of time that must protect profit. Or must protect labor costs. And you also spoke about the invisible hand.
Mm-hmm.
And is the invisible hand, is the moving of currency across borders another example of that invisible hand that you spoke about?
Well, the invisible hand is a notion about the manner in which capitalism functions that makes it look like it's a system that generates the best possible welfare while people are trying to be massively greedy. And it's a philosophical foundation for economics that Adam Smith gave us in a throwaway line, effectively, which has been the obsession of economics to prove. And in fact, if you look at what they've proven it doesn't exist. And physicists like Joe McCauley make a very strong case in that direction, that the invisible hand, mathematics shows that it doesn't work the way that economists believe and it doesn't do the welfare maximizing. He often said, well, people have often said, there's an invisible hand and it's in your pocket picking it. So to have the beneficent line is a rather different thing. If you want to look at what's happening with finance markets, and your best person to read is probably George Soros, who not only writes about it, but has well and truly made a fortune out of it. So he's got a much better handle on what actually happens there, and it's speculative waves and non-speculative waves. Sometimes that'll add to profit, other times it destabilizes the system. And we saw that drastically with Indonesia, where, first of all, there was a large speculative push of lending to Indonesia. This is back at the Asian crisis period. Then people realized the amount they'd lent and the way in which the money had been wasted, because a lot of it had gone to Suharto family cronies, meant that Indonesia had little or no capacity to repay that debt. And in a period of, I think, what, 3 weeks from memory, he went from 2,500 rupiah to the dollar, American dollar, to 12,500 rupiah. At one stage, I think it actually hit 17,500. Now, that basically means you're making the economy worthless.
Yeah.
So the speculative flows, which are all about trying to get maximum profit out of financial flows, ended up destroying the economy for a temporary period. There was still a functional economy. Nothing had happened to the amount of material wealth being generated in Indonesia. It was the financial value that had been destroyed. And yet, of course, that financial value being destroyed in the wash-up had a pretty drastic effect on the productive capacity of Indonesia as well. So finance, that sloshing around money of international borders, can have real impact on the real economy.
I would imagine it has. And with that, I'm going to wrap this because you've had a long night.
Thank you. And my voice is about to die.
Yes, I know. Steve Keen, thank you so much for being on Fourth Estate Radio on the Head On Radio Network. We'll talk to you soon.
Indeed. Thanks, Matt.
You know, the president came out and talked about the Iraq War and how he had a strategy to win the peace. I have some exclusive audio. This is actually him preparing for the speech in front of the mirror. This is him laying out the strategy for Iraq.
That was the most coherent thing I've heard him say in ages, man.
You know, if he really spoke that way, it would be so much better for us all. Because at least then we would know that he's an incoherent bastard. We could have him locked up.
And that's just a taste of what Bruce and I got up to last weekend. Come and join us next weekend, Saturday night, 10 p.m. Eastern. To get the stream details, go to fourthestateradio.com. That's fourthestateradio.com.
Guy James Means, straight talk and great guests like author and reporter Greg Palast.
Do we have Greg on the phone?
Yes, we do.
All right, very good, Greg.
Greg talked about his new book, Armed Madhouse.
You'll see in the second chapter of the book about Big Oil that I was able to get the inside documents from inside the State Department for the plans for the oil fields of Iraq, which is, you know, what it, you know, it's about the oil. And you actually, you know, if you thought they had a secret plan, I go and get it.
Greg Palast, thank you so much.
Don't miss Guy James weekday afternoons, 3 to 5 Eastern Time, right here on the Head On Radio Network.
feel. This is not a test, it's not a drill. Take no prisoners, only kill.
Good evening, everyone. This is Bruce Birch for Fourth Estate Radio. Welcome to a very special edition of the Fourth Estate Lecture Series. This week, we have best-selling author and journalist Robert Fisk. Fisk, based in Beirut, Lebanon, as Middle East correspondent of London's The Independent, has lived in the Middle East for almost three decades. He currently holds more British and international journalism awards than any other foreign correspondent. His book, entitled Pity the Nation, A History of the Lebanon War, has won great critical acclaim. And now, Fourth Estate Radio and MGK New Media proudly bring you, from Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia, Robert Fisk.
Welcome to you all, visitors, friends, students and colleagues of Macquarie University and from those who've come to join us here tonight. Apologies from our Vice-Chancellor Stephen Schwartz, who's unable to be with us tonight, but on behalf of the Vice-Chancellor, I would like to take the opportunity to welcome you here in this lecture theatre, as well as those of you who are scattered in other parts of the university taking the audiovisual feed. Our speaker tonight, Robert Fisk, will be read by some of you as the Middle East correspondent of The Independent in London. Only some, because The Independent astutely requires payment for online access to his articles. But many more of you will have read him on the various websites that pick up those articles. He will be known to many others as the author of Pity the Nation, Lebanon at War, to more people again for his frequent appearances on ABC Radio National, and to everyone here for last year's The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East. The book shows that to make sense of what is happening in the Middle East now, we must understand the history of the region in all its complexity. In Fisk's own words, the journalists should be, quote, the first impartial witnesses to history, which is the why as well as the what and where, and that our tragedy lies always in our past because history's power is inescapable. Thus, the Great War for Civilization is a remarkable attempt to take experience, captured in the author's haunting line that, quote, in a quarter of a century, I've seen thousands of corpses, and to place that experience in a larger context from which to challenge authority. I am looking, Fisk writes, for the kaleidoscope to stop turning, to see the loose flakes of memory reflected in some final, irremediable pattern. Much has happened since the book was finished in June last year, and so tonight is an opportunity for us to see the latest turn of the kaleidoscope, to see more of that pattern. For giving us this opportunity, I congratulate the organiser of tonight's public lecture, the Centre for Middle East and Northern African Studies, led by Dr. Andrew Vincent and Professor Christy Slade, who is head of the division. And it's with great pleasure that I welcome this evening's speaker, Robert Fisk. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, can you all hear me at the back, okay? Yep, great. I'm glad no one told you to turn your mobile phones off, because a few months ago in Dublin, Ireland, I said that anyone whose mobile phone rang while I was talking would be sold into slavery. And immediately a mobile phone went off, and it was mine. And it's on now, because I've just had to call the editor to see if he's got my piece for tomorrow morning's paper. It's good fun launching a book and writing for a newspaper at the same time. And that was a joke. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to talk to you principally tonight about journalism and our failures, especially our failure in the last 30 years in the Middle East, and particularly our failures over September 11th, 2001. On 2001, September 11th, I was crossing the Atlantic. It's a good place to be on that day, and I was using my satellite phone to talk to my editor in London, which shows I was flying business class, doesn't it? In any event, he was saying to me, the first plane has gone into the World Trade Center. Now another plane, not a tragedy, it's obviously an attack. Then we had the Pentagon, then we had Pennsylvania, and I went up the front of the aircraft to see the crew, whom I knew, because I travel almost every month to America. And I said to the chief purser, you better tell the captain what's happening. And he came back and I told him everything I knew. He was sending me back to the phone to learn more. And the chief stewardess at the front of the aircraft said, you know, there must have been many of them. They all wanted to die. Where did the planes come from? Because at this stage we didn't know they were domestic flights from Boston, LaGuardia and so on, the four aircraft that were crashed by the hijackers into America. We thought they could have come from Latin America, Africa, or Europe. And I looked at the purser and he looked at me. And we went round the plane together looking for passengers we didn't like. I found 13. Three in business class. He found 14. Almost exactly the same. Because, of course, they were all Muslims, weren't they? They had darker skin or beards or were playing with worry beads or reading a Quran or they were looking suspiciously at me. Because I was looking suspiciously at them. And I realized when I got back to the front of the aircraft, and in just 2 minutes, Osama bin Laden, for I was sure it was he, had turned nice, liberal, friendly Bob into a racist. I was going around my aircraft, within 2 minutes, racially profiling the passengers, along with the crew. I thought then that this was not really an attempt to divide Muslims from the West. We don't say Christians because there aren't a lot left. But in fact an attempt to divide the innocent from the innocent. I should have known, and I did, I was certain it was bin Laden, and I'll tell you why. The last time I met him, I've met him three times, we were on a camp in the mountains of Afghanistan, built originally by the CIA, of course. And he said to me the last words, and I was copying them out in my notebook, Mr. Robert, from this mountain upon which you're sitting, we destroyed the Soviet army and brought down the Soviet Union. Bit of an exaggeration, but some truth. Afghanistan did play a leading role in destroying the Soviet Union. And then he said, I pray that God permits us to turn America into a shadow of itself. And I noticed when my researcher, Victoria, came with my notebooks. She went through 328,000 Fisk notebooks, pieces of paper, files, newspaper clippings, photographs, videotapes. Otherwise, I'd still be writing the book now if she wasn't there. She found the notebook, which I was taking down the notes from bin Laden. And on that section, that last section, I have two lines written vertically on each side of the page with the word rhetoric, question mark. I was wrong. When I got back to Europe and I saw the Twin Towers descending in that biblical, appalling, epic collapse. And all the smoke and ash spreading across Manhattan. I remember thinking, well, New York is certainly now a shadow of itself. He got that phrase right. That night, of course, my mobile phone was ringing like a budgerigar. NBC, ABC, ABC Australia, Irish television. And it was Irish television where I had the most intriguing insight into what was going to happen. On the aircraft, I'd already written two articles, one about bin Laden and the other one saying, in the days to come, we will not be allowed to ask the question, why? And of course it turned out to be true. You could say, who did it? 19 Arabs who said they were Muslims. You could say, how did they do it? Box cutters, aeroplanes, tall buildings. But what would happen when you asked the question, why? And that night I found out. Because I was condemned by a Harvard professor, whom I shall not name. It's Alan Dershowitz, of course. And who said that merely to ask the question, he said I was a dangerous man, and that merely, this is before he was pulled off the program, and they pulled the plug on him, I was a dangerous man, and merely to ask this question meant that I was pro-terrorist and anti-American, which was the same as being anti-Semitic. That's what he said. I've got the tape recording if you want to hear it. Now, the point is, of course, that I got the message. To ask the question why, and here we approach what Edward Said called the last taboo. You can talk about it in America, you can talk about gays, lesbians, blacks, but you mustn't talk about America's relations with Israel and the Middle East. To ask the question why meant you were a Nazi now. Indeed, after this period, I got a lot of postcards in the mail, many of them from the United States, telling me that my mother was Adolf Eichmann's daughter. My mum was in the RAF during the Battle of Britain, repairing radios on damaged Spitfires so they could go and shoot down the Luftwaffe, but that didn't matter. I keep all my rotten mail, but these ones, frankly, went in the kitchen bin. But you see the problem there. If there's a crime on the streets of Sydney, no, Canberra, the first thing the police do is look for a motive. But when we had an international crime against humanity, killing more than 3,000 people, the one thing we were not supposed to do was look for a motive. Isn't that odd? I mean, 19 Arabs that came from the Middle East. Is there a problem out there? That, of course, was not supposed to be part of the narrative. And what I'm trying to do in my book, and this is not a plug for my book, because you could never sell like this a book of 1,300 pages, but what I've tried to do, and what the book is really about, and I think I only realized this when I finished it after 20 months, is to say we must not accept the narrative of history and events laid down for us by our presidents and our prime ministers and our generals, and I'm sorry to say our journalists too. We've got to break away from that narrative and see realities as they are. You know, all the signs have been there. Palestine, Chechnya, Bosnia, Afghanistan, now Iraq. For 30 years, I've been a witness to almost all these tragedies. And I used to believe, when I started off in journalism, that being a foreign correspondent was being the first witness to history. That I could see things, and with the help of an editor who trusted me, and my God, thank goodness, I've had editors trust me and print what I write, and I don't get censored, to tell it how it is, so that no one can ever say, you didn't tell us, nobody told us, we didn't know. I put this point to that very fine Israeli journalist, Amira Haas, in Jerusalem more than 2 years ago, and she said, no, Robert, you're wrong. She said, our job is to monitor the centers of power, to challenge authority, especially when they go to war, especially when they're going to kill people, and especially when they're going to use lies to do it. And I think that that is the best definition I have ever heard of what a correspondent should do in his work. Whether he does is a different matter. It's interesting that Amira's theory came about because of her experience of her mother in the Second World War. Amira's mother was a Jewish partisan with Tito. She was forced to surrender to the Nazis after the Gestapo surrounded her town, I think it was Cetinje in Bosnia, and said they would kill every woman and child unless she did surrender, so she did. And she was put on a train to Germany, and the train arrived close to a concentration camp, and she, with other women dressed in rags, walked up a long road through a middle-class farming area to the concentration camp. And it was breakfast time, and out of these rather elegant wooden houses with their wooden beams came various hausfraus, still drying the cups and saucers, to lean over the fence and watch these women in rags pass by. And her mother told Amira, there's one thing I cannot stand, and that is people who watch from the side. And Amira said, I will never allow people to watch from the side. And that is her basis of being a correspondent. Don't let people watch from the side. Tell them what is happening. Tell them to do something. Force them to do something. Persuade them to do something. I want, as I said, to focus tonight on our responsibility as journalists and why we have failed to answer the why question. It's quite easy to see how we've gone wrong in a very simple sense in our reporting of the conflict between, I always put Palestine in quotation marks, Palestine does not exist yet, if it's going to, and Israel. The typical example is when journalists began, after Colin Powell sent an instruction to American diplomats in the Middle East to do this, to refer to the occupied territories as the disputed territories. Subtle difference, isn't there, in the semantics? Occupied territories became disputed. After all, Oslo was supposed to sort it out. Then you notice colonies, Jewish colonies for Jews and Jews only on Arab land, became settlements. And very frequently now they are neighborhoods or outposts. And the wall, 20 feet high, has become a security barrier. Or even more metaphysically, a fence in the press. I mean, I remember the Berlin Fence, but we didn't actually call it that. And this is taller than the Berlin Fence. And we certainly didn't call it the Berlin Security Barrier. That's what the German Democratic Republic called it. Remember, they were trying to stop people getting in, as opposed to people getting out. It reminds me of the famous occasion when one of the deals Arafat accepted was that 10 square miles of the West Bank would be a nature reserve. And I was always asking the paper, were the animals going to be inside or around the outside of the wire? But you see, the problem with the semantics which I'm explaining to you is that, and I'm against violence for any reason ever against anyone, if a child chucks a stone at a tank, or a gunman fires at a settlement, and it's just a land dispute, something that could be solved over a cup of tea or in a law court, then obviously this is an outrageous thing to do. If you delete occupation and make it dispute, or if you turn a colony into a neighbourhood, a nice friendly neighbourhood like North Sydney, then obviously anyone who throws a stone or shoots at it is generically violent. You can't talk to them, they're terrorists. Now again, I'm against all violence for any reason ever. But by de-semanticizing the Middle East, we make it incomprehensible. You know, when I'm in the States, and I open the papers, I simply have no idea what's going on. I have to dial up Beirut and ask my friends. At least they can read to me from an Arab press that's more or less trying to get it right. And the worst thing of all is the osmotic.
All right. Hey, you're back live with Bruce Birch on the Bruce Birch Radio program, being brought to you live by the Head On Radio Network. You know, folks, I want to really apologize. First of all, I'd like to apologize for a freak of nature. We had a rip-roaring, and actually it's still going on outside, but it's not quite as bad as it was once, and I'm calling to you over a cell phone because I have no electricity and the phone lines are also down. So I don't know. I mean, you know, global warming? Yeah, maybe. Maybe. We had some pretty strong storms roll through my neck of the woods here and got to the point where I actually retreated to an inner wall because I really, you know, it just got really bad. But wanted to thank my producer, Agnes Kincaid, for carrying on like a trooper with the rest of the radio program as I sit here looking at candles. You know, and also Wayne Matson for joining us on the program today. We'll try to go ahead and get him on next week again on Friday, and hopefully we won't have a rip, snorting thunderstorm to roll through and take out the radio program. I'd also like to thank John Fox for engineering the program and for bringing the voice of the horn to life by announcing the show, and Peter Godbold of Godbold Computer Services for making the internet stream even when the electricity goes poof. Last but not least, I want to thank all of my listeners. Thank you for sticking around for the rest of the program. You know, again, I apologize for the lack of rest of the show, but, you know, such is life. We soldier on because that's what we do. We're liberals. We're progressives. We keep moving forward. That's our job. And also want to thank the West Virginia District Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. You guys are building the American dream right here on the Head On Radio Network. And last but not least, folks, remember, it's your democracy too, and it's not a spectator sport. So get out there and do something for the United States. Make democracy happen. I'd like to thank you for joining me this week. This is Bruce Birch for the Bruce Birch Radio Program. See you tomorrow night for Fourth Estate Radio. And we'll be back on Monday. Talk to you soon.
Was a time I'll always remember. I could never forget.